this episode of Comedy Rewind. Where does the Wayne's World Bohemian Rhapsody scene rank amongst the most iconic of the decade? Does talking to the camera work, or is it just cheesy now? Will bleeping swear words make this podcast more accessible and funnier? All of this and more on Comedy Rewind.
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 Push rewind. I thought this was a comedy show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to Comedy Rewind. We are powered by Audio Technica and 8bit.net as we rewatch the great comedies of the 1990s. I'm your host, Jono Peck, and party on, Logan Wilkinson. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Jono?
I mean, I'm fantastic.
This fine, beautiful Friday afternoon or Saturday morning, wherever you are in the world, listening to this, driving your little car full of nuns. It's a great time to be alive, man. You know what I mean?
That's it. It is. And I get to chat with you. It's always a pleasure.
Yes, absolutely.
You're our very first international, I guess New Zealand counts as international, but you're our first American listener, co-host.
Here's the thing, and it's time that Tom knew this. New Zealand is basically just a colony of Australia, and they should just like be, like they're like the, like, I don't know, like eighth state of Australia. I think you have seven states. Is that right? Six states, maybe?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, see, I knew it. Yeah, I did. Don't question myself. Yeah, eighth state of Australia, basically.
Well, you said it, not me, so New Zealand can direct its hate towards...
All the Kiwis can direct their anger to me, yeah.
Yeah. So, Logan, tell us a bit about what you do.
You can find me all across the internet here, at LifterLogie on Twitter, all the other things that exist, I guess. I'm a chucklehead who talks about video games and other things. I like movies a lot, music.
And
I like...
writes about them. Too.
Yes, and writes about them, podcasts about them, do a lot of podcasts, do a lot of writing, trying to get more into the writing part again. Just generally try to be a cheerful little fellow on the internet and mainly just talk a lot about, you know, pizza, video games, movies, and Hamilton and Taylor Swift. New
Fantastic.
Album is rad.
Great. Well, we've got a movie here to talk about, and it's Wayne's World.
Wayne's World.
Which is something that was... I wouldn't say it was a huge part of my childhood, but it was definitely a presence. It was something that was
absolutely.
Always there. It was something that was definitely referenced a lot amongst a couple of my friends. I always mention, shout out to Smallsy, friend of the show. We watched a lot of these movies together. There was a lot of schwing happening in certain parts of our adolescence. What's your early memories of this film?
So it is definitely, I feel like, similar ways, like, Wayne's World was like a part of like growing up in like the 90s, early 2000s. I feel like the movie came out
92,
the year I was born, right? The year I was born. So I was like, what, February? So I was literally a month old when this movie came out. But like, obviously, like Wayne's World and Mike Myers had such a huge kind of pop culture effect that like it was always on TV. And so, like, by like the end of the 90s, I'd seen this movie, and then into the 2000s, I watched it again and again and again. It was funny to like watch the movie again, and then in particular immediately after viewing, like going to the Wikipedia page and reading it, and like I hadn't really realized that like this was the thing that like popularized That's What She Said. Like when I first kind of saw it on Wikipedia page,
yeah.
I was like, oh, that's crazy. Like I'd never really thought about that, but it was like it predates Michael Scott from The Office kind of thing, right? And like Party On is obviously like one of the big ones. And then for me and my friend group, it was like the not part of like saying like a really positive statement and just being like, not, and then just like kind of like laughing at me and dumb and chucklehead about that.
Yep.
But I feel like it's something that, like, I really like Mike Myers a lot. Like, he's one of my favorite 90s comedians. And I don't know if this is my favorite Mike Myers movie, but it's definitely in the running. And it's probably the Mike Myers movie that I have, like, the most, like, soft spot nostalgia place in my heart. And certainly the one that I watched, like, not kind of trick, the one that I watched most as a kid was Wayne's World for sure. And like, it is funny, like, reading about it and watching it again, and just like the idea of Wayne's World, of just like two or just like a few friends doing like a low production, essentially like early podcast, basically, if you want to call it that, like TV show, like in their basement. It's like, oh man, like a lot of us are basically just doing like a modern version of Wayne's World in our own basements or living rooms or bedrooms now. And like, I loved that too, being like, oh man, like we kind of became Wayne and Garth in our own way, which is like in itself kind of really cool.
Yeah. The original content creators.
Yeah, exactly, right? The original content creators out there.
Yeah, it's interesting the way you talk about Mike Myers and this being the film that you go back to. Was it, for you, something where you'd probably discovered him via another movie like Austin Powers or something and then went back to Wayne's World being a bit younger and maybe not getting caught up in those movies originally?
It's weird. It's hard, obviously, because like, it's all like smushed together, but like I definitely feel like I saw this before I saw Austin Powers, and I would have probably seen this before I saw Shrek. Like, this would have been one of the earliest Mike Myers movies I would have seen. Mm. Like, this, and I remember, I was older when I saw this other one, but, like, I remember seeing, I think it's, like, I'm Married to an Axe Murderer.
So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Yeah, which is one of my all-time favorite deep cut movies. Like, I loved that movie when I saw it. And, like, I've only seen it, like, two or three times. And, like, I love that movie, and, like, nobody knows it. It's, like, a super deep cut Mike Myers movie, I feel like. And I love that film. And, like, that and Wayne's were, like, the two I watched and, like, really, really, like, took hold of me, right? Like, even more than Austin Powers, I like Wayne's World.
Mm. Okay. So, for me, it's a little similar, whereas, you know, I was only 5 when this movie came out, and I very much discovered it on VHS as a rental later in early adolescence, where there was probably, I don't know, I was probably 9 or 10 years old when I first saw it. And, you know, it's not super edgy or it's not like vulgar or anything, so I'm pretty sure my parents would have been happy for me to be watching a movie like this. And it was, I think, made as kind of a dumb comedy, but it was filmed by some very smart people, including I guess Lorne Michaels being the Saturday Night Live I don't know what you call him, godfather,
executive producer, showrunner,
executive producer. And this was that first, well, not the first, but it was the second first, probably one. Successful branch from a sketch into a film. Airheads came before this and didn't do quite so well. So I think we've got a film here that's based around a very kind of loose concept, and it was a challenge to see if they could extrapolate it into a full-length film, which at the time it was really successful. It made $183 million on a budget of only $20 million. But looking back at it now, I'm not quite so sure that it holds up as well as it did at the time. And I know, like, our friend Brendan White recently watched this as well and wasn't overly impressed by how well it holds up. And some of that, I think, is to do with the style of the film. And maybe it's like the breaking the fourth wall thing that feels a bit thin compared to how we make movies now. But we can get into all of that stuff a bit later on. I think as far as my, like, early memories, I don't even know if I saw this before Wayne's World 2. It was one of them.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I'm not sure which one I saw out of those two films first.
Yeah. It was definitely something, as I mentioned before, it was very quotable. Mm-hmm. Definitely some moments you mentioned before, some expressions that became part of the lexicon, especially amongst young people. But this was a Bonnie and Terry Turner written film, along with Mike Myers, who people might know as the creators of Third Rock from the Sun and That 70s Show. They also, I'm pretty sure they worked on Cone's Head and Tommy Boy and the Brady Bunch movie as well. So they are some fairly prolific comedy writers, especially in the 90s. And this movie was made in 34 days. I'm not sure if that was to fit around the Saturday Night Live production, but pretty quick turnaround there. And I don't want to say it shows, but it's because it's hard to tell if it's just the fact that it was filmed in 92 that makes it feel like it's, I don't know. It does seem like a cheaper movie in some aspects. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I think, I don't know, like, it sounds like, based off what you're saying and what we kind of heard before recording, I feel like I might be the one who enjoys this movie the most out of the three of us. Like, I think it's still, I still enjoy this, and, like, definitely it's part of the thing of, like, I like the 90s, and, like, this is, like, a seminal 90s film, I feel like, in terms of comedy and its influence. But also because, like, I think, especially watching it now, like, I like the kind of maybe slightly low budget, like, fourth wall break and stuff. And then the fact that it's just, like, two guys trying to do, like, a show. And I was like, man, like, I'm just kind of Wayne out here just trying to do a show, just kind of, like, be a goofy thing, trying to just, like, hang with Cassandra. Like, I'm here for that. And, like, it's also that thing of Mike Myers is just, like, really, really charming. And he is just, like, he's just really, and this is, like, right as he's entering peak Mike Myers years, from, like, now all the way to probably, like, Shrek 2, like, that phase, like, that, like, 12-year period, like, he's just peak. And I think, for me, I really loved seeing this kind of, obviously, the very early Mike Myers film, a very early kind of younger Myers. Myers and Dana Carvey's chemistry is stupid good. Like, it's so crazy how good the chemistry is and how, like, well they work together on screen. I think there are scenes from this movie that, like, when I watched it years and years and years ago, I still think about to this day. And, like, the ending is one of them, which I feel like is going to be one of the most, like, maybe disagreement-filled parts of this discussion, possibly, but, like, I loved the ending. As a kid and watching it again now, I'm like, man, it is still really, it's still pretty cool. And then, like, obviously, like, I feel like the most iconic scene of the entire film, the Bohemian Rhapsody thing, absolutely still works. Like, it absolutely still lands, I feel like. And so, like, all of the best parts of the movie, I feel like, are still stand up and are still
hold up, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely still hold up and are still, like, great comedic moments. And the parts that maybe aren't as good, I feel like there aren't just a ton of them, so it doesn't overwhelm it. So I enjoyed it. Like, Wayne's World was never my favorite 90s movie growing up as a kid, like, comedy. But it was definitely one that I always really enjoyed talking about and, like, watching. And I think watching it again now, it's like, yeah, I'm still content with what this movie is and happy with what this movie is.
Yeah, there's definitely a unique style to this film. It's a blend of,
yeah,
like,
I think that's it too.
Yeah, it's a good kind of, it's a blend of breaking the fourth wall. There's a lot of meta gags,
yeah,
catchphrases.
The gags, yeah.
There's a good flavor of that rock and metal culture of the early 90s.
It's almost like a meme movie before memes are even a thing. It kind of is like this very, like, meta, like, tongue in cheek, just like. All, yeah. It's like everything is just like an inside joke, and it's just, it's, I really kind of appreciate the fact that that movie is just so weird. Like, I don't really know if the movie would work. Like, I don't even know if they could make a movie like this now, but, like, I don't even think they really could have made a movie like this then. And it just kind of came out and existed, and there's, like, not really a lot of other comedies like it.
Yeah, it kind of walks the line between something like a straight comedy, like something maybe like Dumb and Dumber, and then, like, a kind of Naked Gun or Hot Shots kind of satire. So you're kind of like, they're talking about, like, they're overtly saying, like, oh, here's some exposition, or just referencing the MacGuffins of the film and all the kind of inside. They're basically laying it out on the table of what's happening in the film. And it's funny at points, and I wonder if that's something that was done much at the time, that kind of blend between straight-up comedy and the spoof.
I feel like it wasn't. I feel like there's not a lot of films that walk that kind of thin middle line between those two genres. And, like, or at least they're, like, do it and do it really well, and I feel like this does it and does it well, because it is, I feel like, a hard marriage to pull off, because there are kind of two very different comedy genres, and I think Wayne's World does it with, like, a very much, like, tongue-in-cheek, like, grin and a smirk, and I kind of appreciate that, like, wink and charm that it knows. It's like, we know that we're, like, right on the cusp of being, like, a bad movie, but we're also, like, we also know the fact that we're not, and so, like, it's this weird thing where, like, we're just like, yeah, like, we... So here's my thing. I feel like Wayne's World in 2019, I look at it and I'm like, this was the original garbage truck on fire of a film where, like, they're like, yeah, like, this is bad and this is bad and this is bad and this is dumb, but, like, it all works in a very, like, kind of funny way where it's like, man, this is a garbage truck on fire, but also, like, that garbage truck on fire is pretty damn good. And, like, I feel like Wayne's World is like, man, this is pretty good, and it's garbage truck on fire, and they know it and they own that, and, like, they work with it.
It's interesting, in my research, seeing that Mike Myers didn't like the movie and he wasn't confident that it would do well. So when him and Rob Lowe were kind of in the test screening together and people loved it, he was almost like shocked at how much people loved it, because it tested really well. And I think that comes down to, there was apparently some disagreements about the editing and the director. We might go into just quickly about the director now. It was Penelope Spheeris. Anyway, she was someone that was known to Lorne Michaels from film school or something like that, and had directed some rockumentaries, The Decline of Western Civilization, Parts 1 and 2. Everything she'd done up to this point was fairly small, low budget, either like drama or horror movie, and this was a comedy that was coming in with a pretty big budget at the time, and she had a real vision of how it should be. But when it came to editing, Mike Myers had his version of what he wanted. Oh, sorry, when it came to shooting, Mike Myers had his version. The Turners, as the writers, had their version, and then she filmed her own and would just edit in mostly what she wanted. And she knew, apparently, that this would get her fired from being able to work on the sequel, which she didn't, because she knew Mike Myers wouldn't be happy. But apparently she just did what she wanted, and it turned out to be a big hit, really big hit. Mm. Do you have a guess as to the Rotten Tomatoes score for this film?
Ooh, what a good question. It's a comedy, so I'm already going to, like, instinctively go lower. I'll say 61%.
84.
Really? Okay, wow, that's very high. Yeah, especially for a comedy, it's super high. Okay, wow, that's awesome, yeah.
Definitely.
It's great. It's a great movie. So.
It is, and, I mean, when I say it's a great movie, mostly I mean it was a really great movie for its time, and we'll get a bit more into how it holds up. But we'll move on to the questions for now, because I think we've laid the table for what's about to come. So just to bring a bit of context in, number one song when the movie released in the US was Michael Jackson's Black or White.
Ooh.
And in Australia, it was Salt and Pepper, Let's Talk About Sex.
Yeah, so, all right. Hell yeah.
So we're talking, you know, that's great the choices. Era. It's and the music is a big part of this film, being that obviously you got Wayne and Garth as metalheads or rockheads. I don't know how metal they really are, but they think they're metal at least.
They're very metal.
And and then Cassandra, obviously played by Tia Carrera. She's a fantastic in this movie. And
yes.
She's the rock goddess, I guess, and the soundtrack for this movie is a good blend of music from previous to this era. It doesn't really date the movie to the 90s specifically. It's kind of more just like, if you're a metalhead, you're probably not listening exclusively to music that's come out contemporarily, are you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's a good point. It is a great soundtrack in this movie, though.
The stars of this film, we'll talk, What Have You Done For Me Lately? Dana Carvey's pretty much moved into stand-up and animation. His career never really took off as a solo film star, I guess. He's played some roles similar to this where it's more of an ensemble. But yeah, leading his own films never really took off for Dana Carvey, which is crazy because he's such an amazing talent. I guess he just didn't have the... I don't know. I don't know what happened, what went wrong for him, but he never had the Mike Myers-esque career that you might have seen from him. I wonder if this film or this series is any part responsible for that, of him getting typecast as kind of the
sidekick.
B, like the side.
I wonder.
As much as he has like some really great moments and some great comedy in this film, he doesn't get a lot to work with as far as like any depth, I guess.
I would feel, and it's interesting too, because from what I remember anyway, I feel like he gets a bigger role under Wayne's World 2 and like more comedic moments to shine in that film. Like, I feel like he gets kind of more time, like, by himself. From what I remember, like, him and Wayne are like separated for a good chunk of that movie. So it's like each of them kind of have their own thing. And so, like, I feel like that movie, he gets a bigger thing. But obviously, Wayne's World 2 wasn't as big as Wayne's World 1. And more to the point, Wayne's World 1 kind of established, I think, the precedent.
Yeah, that's right. So Mike Myers is currently working on a comedy series for Netflix, which is pretty cool. Like, he hasn't done a lot of live action lately. It's a lot of, like, he went into the Shrek world for a really long time. And maybe that's because his last couple of movies didn't do so great. Love Guru, the third Austin Powers movie. I can't really think of any other attempts at leading a comedy from him. He went into Inglourious Basterds. He kind of done a bit more serious stuff in like really small parts. So him coming back with a comedy series for Netflix, I think that that's going to be interesting, because we haven't really seen what he can do as, I guess, the creative talent for a while, at least.
Yeah, for some time, right? Yeah. But that's the thing. That's the thing again, where I said it earlier, where it's like, from like here to like Shrek 2, like that era, he was like, every film he was in was basically just like, this is great. Like, it's, he just had like a hell of a run, like at basically the most of the 90s into like early 2000s. So it's like, he also was great for, like, he also had a run. I love Mike Myers. Like, if I had to do like a Mount Rushmore of like SNL alum, Mike Myers is probably on like that list. He's probably in like the top five. Like, it's close.
Wow.
Like, especially for like on a, like, after SNL run, but also like on SNL, like Mike Myers is so wicked. Like, that Mike Myers era, like the late 80s, early 90s, is definitely like one of the golden runs of SNL. But like that cast is stacked. And so, and it kind of helped like save SNL. And so I think Mike Myers is just like an incredibly talented comedian, right? And like Wayne's World is a weird one too, I feel like, where without it, I don't know if we would have gotten any of the other kind of SNL alums to then have their own. Like, I feel like it paved the way for like Adam Sandler and Chris Farley and Will Ferrell and all these people to kind of do their own film projects and do their own film things. And so I think
while they were still cast members, you mean?
Yeah, exactly, right. And so I feel like it helped pave the way for the people too, and like Mike Myers doing it, because like before Myers, there'd really only been like Eddie Murphy and Chevy Chase and like Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray, but Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray were like so different that I feel like the track record is like shakier, and then I feel like Meyer is kind of like, now, like, I'm going to be a movie star based on what I've done on SNL,
yeah,
and just going to accept it.
Yeah, he didn't have as prolific, like, 90s as, like, an Adam Sandler or a Jim Carrey, but he definitely had a good strike rate for the movies he was putting out up till they started to kind of fall apart. As far as the Mount Rushmore goes, I've just jotted down while you were talking.
Yeah, give me your...
Yeah, this is mine. I think you're going to have a hard time arguing against it, to be honest. But I've got Eddie. Mm-hmm. I've got Will Ferrell.
Mm.
I've got Adam Sandler. And I've got Bill Murray, as far as post-SNL careers.
For post-SNL... So we're talking, like, not SNL work, just post-SNL work.
Yeah, yeah. Because otherwise you'd have, like, Chris Farley on there, I think.
So I think... Based on post-SNL work alone, Bill... Eddie and Will, I think, are probably... Certainly Bill and Eddie are unquestionable, I think. Like, you can't really argue with that.
So you might put Mike Myers ahead of
Will
Ferrell?
I think I could put Mike Myers ahead of Adam Sandler. I think there's an argument to be made for that, at least.
Okay. Interesting. I've got you on the right podcast, then.
Yeah, like, I think... Because like, I pulled up Mike Myers' like filmography here. And he didn't appear in a ton of movies between, like I said, like Wayne's World to Shrek 2, like those, that kind of 12-year gap. But like the ones he were in, right, like Wayne's World, Sorry Married an Axe Murderer, Wayne's World 2, Austin Powers 1, 54, Thin Pink Line, Pete's Meteor. Those are all shakier. But then like Austin Powers 2, which is probably the best Austin Powers film, Mystery Alaska, Shrek, Austin Powers 3, Cat in the Hat, View from the Top, Shrek 2. Like, he gets dicey at the end, but, like, that's a pretty good run, right? And, like, I feel like, certainly I'd argue critically, Mike Myers is probably ahead of Adam Sandler, right? Like, I feel like Mike Myers' best films, critically at least, would be, like, ahead of Adam Sandler's best movies.
That's possible. But yeah. Critics have never really liked Adam Sandler that much,
yeah,
I guess. Anyway, that's a great side tangent.
We could do a whole podcast of just ranking SNL alums.
Yeah, we might do a bonus episode or something sometime. That'd be fun. You know how much we love ranking things.
I love ranking things so much.
We better move on. So Tia Carrera as Cassandra, she's kept working consistently, really, throughout her, like, since the Wayne's World to now. So shout out to her. Nothing quite as iconic as this role, I think. She was awesome in this movie. Yes. And just he's not a big part of the film, but I think we should mention Ed O'Neill has had kind of probably the best recent career of anyone in this film with his tenure on Modern Family.
I mean, so
all that money.
Are you not going to talk about Rob Lowe? Because Rob Lowe's one.
Oh, sorry,
Rob Lowe's. Yeah,
actually, no, I'll take that. Rob Lowe has had kind of a resurgence since Parks and Rec. I don't know if he went away completely. But he's. I just listened to an interview with him on Mark Maron's podcast that was, I don't know, probably a year old by this point. But yeah, he's an interesting dude, and he's had a pretty decent career. So shout out to Rob Lowe.
Yeah, West Wing for sure.
Yeah, that's right. And this film was his first comedy. Like, he hosted Saturday Night Live, and that was when either Lorne or Mike Myers was like, you could be the bad guy in this movie. And I've got a lot to say about that character coming up soon. But for now, what is the most 90s moment of Wayne's World?
Ooh.
There's a lot of things. Like, this movie is very 90s.
It's a very 90s film.
For example, the opening scene of the film, we've got Rob Lowe and his girlfriend or mistress, I don't know, lying on their bed. They're watching an old TV, you know, the old CRT box televisions. There's an ad on the telly for a clapper, like, light system, you know. That's very 90s. They're watching this cable TV show filmed in this guy's basement. That is all just very 90s. You wouldn't see anything like that now. Or, I don't know, the 80s might have even been too early for some of that stuff. There's a scene where Wayne pulls out his portable CD player in the car.
Oh, yeah, he does.
And just the whole angle of Garth hacking that satellite over America to pinpoint this limo and beam the broadcast into the record label executive's limo. Like, that's that scene and the kind of screen on his computer, it looks like a old video game, like an almost like a Space Invaders style video game as he's interfacing with the satellite. Those all struck me as very 90s moments, but What did you have?
Yeah, it's interesting too, because like now that I think about this more, like you can make the case even like the Bohemian Rhapsody scene, right? Like, would you even be listening to the radio now in 2019 if you had all these people in the car, right? Like, would you, or would you just have like somebody's like iPhone, like Bluetooth to the thing, and like have like some sort of like Spotify play? Like, that's the thing. Like, even that like could arguably be like a very 90s like scene.
I think they throw a cassette tape in for that.
I mean, it's a cassette tape. And it's very 90s, right there.
Yeah, like, yeah, it is. I think Wayne says like, "Let's listen to Bohemian Rhapsody." It's something along those lines.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I just watched this a couple of days ago. So that's a good segue into what's the most iconic scene, because I'm not sure you could have an answer besides the opening with Bohemian Rhapsody. And my memory of this was a little different from how it actually is, because that Bohemian Rhapsody sing-along in the car is broken up with a few moments of picking up their friend who's like,
I'm just gonna
hungover or whatever. He's pre-hangover, I guess. And then you've got, they're stopping to look at the guitar in the window that becomes a plot point, semi-plot point later on. But yeah, interspliced around those moments are this sing-along of Bohemian Rhapsody, which, that's probably the scene that sticks out in my mind, or is the first thing, the first visual that you think of when you hear Wayne's World.
I mean, I think that scene is one of the most iconic comedy scenes, right? Like, that scene is so iconic, I feel like, to the point now where, for people our age, honestly, like, that is, if somebody says, like, Bohemian Rhapsody, that's probably one of the first things they think of is that scene, right? Like, if you think of Queen, even, like, it's a weird thing where, like, that was my first introduction to Queen, probably. Or, like, certainly one of the first ones. Like, that was my first introduction to Bohemian Rhapsody, probably, right? Like, because when I'm first watching the movie, like, Freddie Mercury had passed away, like, what, probably, like, 6 months before this movie came out. And so,
he had apparently seen the clip before.
Yeah, that's what I read, too.
Yeah.
But, like, he'd passed away already. So, Queen was done. And so, it's, like, that. But, and so, by the time I was, like, 6, 7, 8, 9, like, watched this movie, it had been, obviously, 6, 7, 8 years since Queen had really been active. And so, like, that would be one, like, and I read too where, like, this movie made that song, like, kind of made it kind of blow up again, right? Like, it went to, like, number 2 in the charts, I think, something crazy like that.
Yeah,
and
it charted higher than it did in its original release.
Right? That's the thing, right? Like, it's the thing where, like, that scene is so iconic, and it's an awesome thing of, I think what makes it so iconic, what makes it so universal, is that, like, everybody has an experience like that in the car driving with their friends, right? Like, whether it's, like, going to high school, like, or leaving high school, or just school in general, or going to, like, the local store, or anything, just all getting in the car and like the song comes on, y'all just like perfectly in sync, start singing it and start like head like banging and like get into it kind of thing. Like, it's such a, I feel like, universal, like 16 17 18 19 year old kid thing, like driving the car around with your buddies and that comes on. Like, and the big one for like our group back in like Missouri was the rare time where like Bohemian Rhapsody itself would come on the radio and we'd basically just reenact the scene, and all of a sudden, like, and it was like, it was great. It was like, oh, it's perfect. It was like the stars aligning kind of thing, right? And like, it's certainly, I think, one of the most like iconic moments of a 90s comedy, but like really comedies in general, like this scene is incredibly like iconic, and like you like immediately know the movie, like what's happening, like this, like it's like everybody knows of this scene.
And it's an interesting thing, because really all it is 4 and then 5 guys singing a song in their car. Like, on paper, the script would have just said Wayne, Garth, and other guys sing Bohemian Rhapsody. And it just, for whatever reason, I guess it's like the song itself and the way that it lends itself to, I guess, characterization in the different like voice parts and harmonies and everything, and like the changes throughout the song. It's just material for comedy for whatever reason, and it works so well. And like you said, I don't know if it made this song what it is, but it certainly did for a lot of people. A lot of people like us, like we wouldn't have known it. Like, we would have known it from eventually hearing it on like a Queen's Greatest Hits album or something, but it wouldn't have had that extra meaning.
You got like a second wind from it, right? Yeah, it's a thing.
And like, I've heard people talk about it who were around at the time, as it wasn't this like huge hit. It wasn't this song. It was like kind of not a B-side. I'm sure it was well liked by Queen fans or whatever, but it wasn't a song that absolutely everybody knew and would drop. Like, I've been in pubs and stuff where it's come on and every conversation has literally stopped And you just like sing the whole thing from start to finish. And that's, I think, a legacy of Wayne's World.
Absolutely. And it's also a thing of like, this was a scene where like Mike Myers fought for Bohemian Rhapsody to be in like the original. Yeah. Do like a different song. And like, I can't even imagine if they'd actually done like a Guns N' Roses like song. Like they were just kind of thinking like, it just so obviously wouldn't have worked as well, I feel like.
That's right.
And so
I think it was either Aerosmith or Guns N' Roses.
Yeah. Right. And like, this is such, and like, it's also a thing, like, it's impossible to even like envision it. Cause like the scene is such an iconic moment, but like, it's such a perfect choice. It's such a great pick. Like it reignited like kind of like, I feel like the passion and like awareness and love of Bohemian Rhapsody. It adds so much to that scene. Right. And like, to your point, I think the simplicity, right, and like kind of the basicness of what has actually happened, like it's just four or five guys in a car headbanging and like singing along to Bohemian Rhapsody, is also what makes it so universal, right, like across the globe, because it is like ultimately just them rocking out to a song, right? Like, so it's not like a crazy like complex wordplay scene, or it's like not something where like it's heavily focused on like dialogue or like an in joke or anything like that, or like it's even more than that, where it's like you can be basically anywhere in the entire world. You don't have to like speak English, but like if you just like have a vague idea of like Bohemian Rhapsody, or even just like there are guys listening to a song headbanging, and you can understand this and like laugh at it and like be like, that's really funny, right? And like, I think that's what makes it so great too, is that regardless of the language you speak or where you're from, it's like it's four guys being dumb and goofy in a car jamming to music, and it's like that's pretty universal, I feel.
Yeah, that's a really good point, I think. And Mike Myers even apparently threatened to walk off or quit the movie if they changed the song. Like, that's how much he was adamant that it really has to be this song. And just, like, some background on that scene, apparently they all had, like, sore necks from the headbanging. And, like, Mike Myers was really, I'm going to say, he was a bit of a prima donna about having to do that. And, like, why do we have to do this? Like, does anyone act like this? It's stupid. Like, it hurts. And the director, to her credit, Penelope Spheeris, as we were mentioning before, was like, no, like, this is what would happen, and this is important, and this will make it. And it really does. Like, that's like the climax of the scene, I guess, when they start headbanging and that guitar solo kicks in. You wouldn't think that it's kind of a 12-second clip of a film would result in that, but apparently it was like 2 days of filming.
That's the thing, like, how many takes, right? Because you can't screw up, like, lip sync in a line or anything, right? You have to hit like every beat. It's like, I bet you they had to film that scene so much to get it right.
And yet Dana Carvey still didn't know the lyrics for the last couple of lines that he's singing. You can see his lips are completely out of sync, and it kind of just plays into a gag, but that's I think he's a little bit embarrassed by that. So we're not even going to dignify any other scenes in this conversation. That's the most iconic scene.
Yeah, it's the one.
What holds up the best apart from that scene?
Yeah, apart from that scene. I think a few different things do, but I think the simplest answer is also maybe the best one, where it's just like Mike Myers and Dana Carvey are really good together, right? Like, their comedic timing. That's the thing. Like, it's just, they're really funny guys. And what, almost 20 years later, like them being really funny guys who have like great chemistry after years on SNL together doing this bit, like they're just, they know these characters and they know each other's beats and moments and like kind of time in, and they work together really well, right? Like, they work so well together is, I think, probably the thing that holds up the best.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier, and I really have to agree that you really can buy into them being friends and being these characters, even though there are some moments, I think, where the gags themselves are a bit weak in hindsight, where they don't exactly land the tone, the pacing, whatever it might be. The characters themselves are really great, and especially when you think that they came out of a sketch on Saturday Night Live, and you think that they had never been seen off their couch, really, and then they had to flesh them out into this kind of full movie. And I wonder if like there would have been people that saw them as kind of a ripoff of Bill and Ted at the time. I think that came out before this, but Mike Myers had built the character years before that, when he was like pre-SNL. It was just something that he'd always used to make his friends laugh, or at Second City, or wherever he was coming up as a improv comedian. I mean, yeah, Bill and Ted was 1989, but I think there are some similarities in like the characters and like the language they use, and that's a big thing in this movie that's quite interesting and might not hold up so great is some of the like slang and stuff that I guess we don't use anymore. But as far as holding up the best, you mentioned the characters. You mentioned there's a lot of catchphrases that are still funny to me today.
Still really funny.
And there's even those expressions that while watching them now, they're not hilarious because we've heard them a million times before, but you can appreciate that they were there to popularize. That's what she said.
Yeah.
The whole, the not jokes.
Yeah.
We've seen them done and have resurgences from The Office, from Borat with the not jokes. And I'm not going to say that Wayne's World was the first to do these because that's definitely not true, but it was probably the first exposure to that style of, of humor for a lot of people. I think the Scooby-Doo ending holds up pretty well.
I agree.
Yeah, that whole diddle-a-doo. Like
I feel like that's one of the most like divisive parts of the movies. Like even as a kid, like among my friend group, some of us liked it, some of us didn't. But like I think it holds up really well, actually. Like it's like I think it's like them leaning as hard as they possibly can into like the meta fourth wall shattering everything. But like I think it's actually really clever and like pretty cool. And like again, it works because like they're in on the joke and they know that we're in the joke, and like I just kind of go along for the ride. And it's like, I don't know, like I really like the multiple endings. Like it's like we're watching like Clue or something here.
Yeah. I don't know if I've seen it elsewhere before. I'm trying to think, but there's something about that, like, oh no, that's not the real ending. That can't be the ending.
Yeah,
we're gonna show you two more versions of it. That I feel like, especially at the time, people would have just been like in hysterics that they would do something that kind of outlandish. And it's a good, I think that there's not really another way to end the movie. I can't think of how they would have done it. Because you can't, like, it ends in a way that you're not exactly sure. Everything's wrapped up so much in a bow that it's like idealistic that it couldn't possibly be real for it to be that perfect, you know, for Rob Lowe's character to get arrested. Like he didn't actually, I don't know if he actually broke
committed
the law.
Committed a crime. Yeah. Right. You're an and then, like, you're going to jail for it.
Yeah. And then you've got like so there's the two different ends of the spectrum with the bad ending, the good ending, and then the Scooby-Doo one in the middle. It kind of keeps you guessing about like what's real. And it's that surreal kind of thing that makes it very memorable, I think.
Definitely. I absolutely agree to that.
So what holds up the worst, as much as some of the stuff we mentioned before is great, I think breaking the fourth wall sometimes feels kind of cheesy and doesn't work so well. I mean, was there anything for you that you felt doesn't age as well as some of the other jokes?
I mean, some of the gags for sure probably don't age well as they did 18 years ago, 17 years ago, whatever it was. I think I like Rob Lowe's character, but I think he also flirts across line constantly of like, this is still good. Is this like still like a great character? Like I'm not sure. Like I think he attempts like doesn't hold up great, but like I think it's probably mostly just like you said earlier, like some of the gags don't land like they landed in 1992, and I think it's just kind of the cumulative nature of them not landing at times. But I also think that it's what we said earlier, it's like an extremely, it's a very 90s movie, and so like if you don't like the 90s or if you don't love 90s comedy, that doesn't hold up well. It is what it is. It's an extremely 90s film and like ways that I think are great and clever and awesome and funny and like and still enjoy. But like if you were somebody who doesn't like those things or just like has no particular like nostalgia for them, well, then that doesn't hold up well because this is what the movie is.
that's a really good point. There's it's that whole meta comedy.
Yeah.
Breaking the fourth wall. Like if you don't respond to that, then you're just going to look at this.
You're just not going to. You're not in for a good ride here, guys.
Yeah, and it's not like people don't do that anymore. Deadpool's a really good example of how well that can work. The TV series Fleabag on Amazon is a good example of that too. But it's a very, I think it dates it in this way. It's a Ferris Bueller's Day Off kind of thing where that's a great movie in itself, but it is that older style where, yeah, I don't know if it's the breaking the fourth wall exactly, but it's the way that it's done. So it's like interspersed throughout the movie, whereas Ferris Bueller is just very much the opening kind of act, and then it doesn't happen when he's around other people.
It can be more jarring here for sure than it is.
Yeah, Wayne's constantly looking at the camera, giving thumbs ups, and that kind of thing. It's like, it's kind of hokey, but And speaking of Rob Lowe, his pants in this movie don't hold up. I always have to throw a fashion critique out there, but he's got some pants that are, they look like five sizes too big. And I know that's probably the style.
That was
the time,
that was the 90s, man. Oof, yeah.
Yeah. The early 90s, at least. There's something in this movie, and I don't know if it's a plot hole or just something that doesn't hold up to me, but the amount that people seem to care about Cassandra's cover band just blows me away. Like, is this an alternate universe where she wrote Ballroom Blitz and she wrote Jimi Hendrix's Fire and Why You Want to Break My Heart? Because, like, if I walk into a room and there's an amazing cover band, I'm not going to be asking them to film a video clip of a music video of one of those covers, and I'm not going to offer them a 6-album deal based off their Ballroom Blitz cover.
I think it's like a thing of, it's basically like an early version of The Voice, right? We're like, you just do covers and you want a giant record deal, except for she didn't go through a competition. They just saw her and were like, you, I like your cover style here. Yeah, you've done it.
Yeah, that perplexed me a little. I was like, because I mean, as a kid, I just thought that these were original songs written
for
the movie.
Sure, I didn't question it. Yeah.
Like, yeah, Let Me Stand Next to Your Fire. That's a song that you've just performed, but it's, now I know it's Jimi Hendrix. You've stolen another artist's material and you're making bank off it. It's not cool. And that brings me to my next and most controversial question. Is Rob Lowe a bad guy? Because I'm not sure, even though he's the villain of this movie, has he done anything wrong?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think he's definitely an like, I think that is what I would say, right? Like, I think he's definitely kind of a
Yeah, like, let's break this down. He comes in, he offers Wayne and Garth $5,000 each. He employs them. He gives their friends jobs as the crew on this TV show. Gives them a platform. You know, we're both content creators. If someone came in and gave us $5,000 to do our podcast, we'd be pretty happy, right?
Yeah.
And if he then asked us to give 2 minutes out of our shows to interview the sponsor, I think we'd be okay with that, right?
I think that's where it is, where it's just like, it's him. I think the idea is that he's going to slowly change the show more and more and more over time, right? Like, it's like that big, like, big business corporate influence, like, influence in the show. And, like, it's like, it's not the same product anymore, man. Like, I think it's that kind of mantra, right? And it's also that thing of, at the very least, like, he was a little too friendly with Cassandra for Wayne's comfort, I'm sure, where Wayne's like, yo, like, kind of like, that's kind of my girl here, man. And you're kind of like, I don't know, I don't like this.
Yeah, he's definitely angling to get with Cassandra, isn't cool, but he's not the, like, he's not an evil villain. Like, I feel like they almost needed to double down and make him a bit more unlikable.
I think he's a great, like, swarmy, like, record salesman, where it's like, hey, I could see this guy running, like, a record label business thing and, like, just being kind of sleazy and just kind of be like, ah, everything's cool, man, or bad, it's all great, like, stick back my hair, it's awesome. And I think it's, like, that guy, it works well. But, like, again, I said earlier where it's, like, Rob Lowe's character, again, floats across the line of being, like, this holds up and this doesn't hold up. And this could be one of the areas where, like, maybe it doesn't hold up.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the part that doesn't hold up is they needed to make him a bit badder. Because in my view, like, Wayne's 100% in the wrong. Like, he signed a contract.
Oh, wow. See, I don't think that.
He took all this money to do this show. And the only reason the show's happening with the money behind it is because of the sponsor. So, like, it's a movie about Wayne discovering capitalism, really. Like, you gotta work for who's paying you.
Yeah, I don't think Wayne's in the wrong, but, like, it definitely, like, it's just, like, don't mess with my show, right? Like, I feel like ultimately, like, an end of this could have been, like, Wayne and Gus should have been, like, we just want to do our show our way, and we're gonna, like, leave corporate sponsor behind, and, like, just do it, just go about it our way, man, back when it was, like, the way it was.
Yeah, then they shouldn't have taken the money to start with, right? Yeah. They shouldn't have signed the contract.
I think it's them learning that lesson of, like, this is what happens in, like, Hollywood and LA gets involved. And they're like, all right, cool, we're good. We'd rather just do our own thing.
Yeah, but I think it's also, like, we're going deeper into this than they probably intended. But
oh, for sure.
That's the price of being successful for a lot of people, is you have to compromise creative.
Yeah.
You know, your creative standards to make a living sometimes. And I'm sure that Mike Myers knows that as the guy that is the comic talent behind this and had to let the director kind of edit the movie to her liking and not his. And any musician that's ever, you know, had success, almost any musician that's had success has probably had to take tips or pointers from a record label or from a producer that's going to say, you need to change this lyric, or you need to add this line, or you need to wear this jacket in this video to make it sell. So I think that the movie starts with Wayne saying he wants Wayne's World to be full time. And this is the opportunity. Yeah. You just have to give this guy an ad to talk about his arcade. He's generously funding the whole show. And he wouldn't do it. He quit because of it.
Can't do it, man. Can't let the man win.
That's the message, is break all contracts, screw the man.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. That's exactly right. If you're listening at home, kids, do that.
So who would be the most offended if this movie came out today? I think it's relatively inoffensive.
Yeah. I don't, like, record labels, maybe? Like, I don't know. TV stations? I don't really, like, I feel like ultimately, yeah, it's a pretty mellow, like, largely inoffensive movie. Like, I'm sure somebody's going to find something to be upset about, but, like, I feel like on the most part, like, it'll be pretty clear.
Yeah, I think especially for an early 90s movie, the way it handled Cassandra's character is really great. Like,
yeah, right?
As an Asian American character, as a woman, she's really empowered and she's measured. She's not emotional. Like, Wayne is clearly the one that gets over emotional at different points in the movie, and she's the one that's like, you need to leave. Like, she's the mature one, really. And as much as her race is a big part of her character and there's jokes about it, there's nothing, to my view, that was offensive, really.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, yeah.
I mean, it is a role that she seems born to play, because she recorded those songs herself. Like, she's on the soundtrack as the singer of them, and just, I can't shout out to her enough. There is a few times that that Wayne or whoever used the term mental to describe someone that's being over emotional. I don't think that's a huge problem, but I know that there would probably be some people who work in mental health that have an issue with that. But language evolves, language changes.
Yeah.
I think that this movie, being a Saturday Night Live product, it's relatively inoffensive to me. Does it pass the internet relevancy test, Logan, via memes and GIFs?
Headbanging scene does for sure.
I think there are a few moments that we see quite frequently in social media.
Yeah.
We're not worthy is a really great...
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that. Oh, my God. Yeah. Like, that whole scene actually is still really great. Yeah.
That was my runner-up to the most iconic scene. Like, the vision of them bowing before Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
That's there. There's a couple times where Wayne gives the thumbs up. You see those GIFs around. I was not aware of that. That's a great little screen cap. And I'm sure there are a couple others as well that, like, if you type them into your little GIF generator, they'll come up. So I think the movie, as far as being, 27 years old, it passes this test. How would smartphones and social media change Wayne's World?
I mean, it'd make the show different, right? Like, Wayne's World would be a podcast now, but, like...
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think there aren't a lot, like, I can't, that's a pretty fundamental way, but, like, I feel like otherwise it's pretty good, but, like, definitely, like, Wayne's would be, like, a podcast or, like, a Twitch show, YouTube show now. That's, like, the biggest one, I feel like.
Yeah, as far as the plot, I don't think that having smartphones would change a whole lot. There's one point where Wayne gets fired, Cassandra gets a phone call from Rob Lowe's character, and she has no idea of what's happened between them, and that there's, like, this animosity between Wayne and Rob Lowe. I can't remember his name, so I'm just going to call him Rob Lowe. But I feel like that is an instance where now she would know everything that happened. She would have got all these texts or tweets or whatever. Or he would have just called her from his phone to her phone to talk about it. Whereas in this movie, she has no idea. She goes off with Rob Lowe to film the music video, and Wayne has to, like, drive all the way across country to get her attention and talk to her, whereas that would possibly just be a phone call now.
Okay, fair enough, yeah.
But, you know, that's a pretty small thing. I think that there would be a social media campaign to bring back Wayne. If he was kicked off his own show.
Free Wayne.
Huge hashtag. Yeah, hashtag free Wayne. And that's that brings us to, could you make this movie in 2019? And what would that version look like? As you said, I think they'd be YouTubers.
They'd be YouTubers or Twitch streamers, and it'd be a podcast. And, like, that's, like, the immediate easy change.
What do you think the style of the film would be?
That's the thing. Like, I could see it honestly being, like, a mockumentary.
Yeah.
I could see it being like something like that, like a mockumentary film now, like following their like trials and tribulations. I think they would still maybe have them break the fourth wall, because that is like an essential element of the film. But like, I think they would do it in different ways, and I think they would tweak that element. But I think I could see it being a mockumentary, or I could see them going the other direction and like making it much more just like a straight comedy. But I think YouTubers Twitch remove for sure. And then, yeah, like I like the idea of it being a mockumentary a lot, actually. I'm going to stick with that. That's my answer. I think I'm making a mockumentary. Okay.
I like that idea. I think that would work pretty well. I think if they were going to make it a straight comedy minus the breaking the fourth wall, it would be more in like the style of something like Harold and Kumar.
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. White Castle, or it might be like Hot Tub Time Machine, where there are still meta gags, and there might be like a wink at the camera throughout the whole movie, but for the most part, it's like non-direct fourth wall breaking. I think that would work. I think there'd have to be some really great cameos with rock stars.
Cameos, I'm sure.
It'd be probably Metallica and Ozzy Osbourne instead of Alice Cooper, perhaps.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty cool. I mean, Wayne's World 3, do you think it's going to happen? I don't know.
No.
I haven't researched the background of this. Do you think it could ever happen?
No. I mean, like,
how can you say no, like, with the climate of films at the
moment? Like, it's...
We're getting a Bill and Ted sequel.
I think Bill and Ted, like, I think people want that more than they want Wayne's World 3, right? Like, because I think we got Wayne's World 2, right? And, like, you have that second film, and it's also that thing of, I think, A, comedy sequels 25 years after the fact have a really terrible track record, but B,
yeah.
I think it's more a thing of, like, I think an essential element of these two characters is that they are, like, late 20s, early 30s kind of guys, like, making their own show, like, chasing their passions, chasing their dreams. And if you made a movie now, if they're still in the basement, you're going to be like, man, that's kind of like, they didn't do it. They didn't make it. Like, I'd be like, it'd be like, that's, I'm really sad. Like, they didn't ever, like, do what they wanted to do kind of thing in any way. And it's like, that's kind of a bummer. So, like, you do that for, like, radically change the story, make them, like, either, like, super successful or they're, like, super failures still. But either way, it's like, A, most importantly, I don't think Mike Myers or Dana Carvey have, like, a ton of interest to do it again. I think they're like,
yeah,
we did too, we're happy with that, we've done other things, we've gone on to change our kind of what we're doing. But B, it's like, I think out of a lot of 90 movies, the like, I think we're more, I'll say this, I think we're more likely to get a straight up remake of the movie than we are to get a Wayne's World 3. That's my answer. We're more likely to get Wayne's World remade than we are to get Wayne's World 3.
I don't think that anyone would touch those characters, because you just can't replace Mike Myers and Dana Carvey. They're such amazing comic talents. I think that would be foolish.
I agree.
But yeah, I mean, I think you're right about those actors not wanting to come back for it. They've both moved on to different things. I'm not even sure they're that close. I know that there was some beef over Mike Myers kind of stealing Dana's impression of Lorne Michaels for Dr. Evil. And that it's been a long time. I'm sure it's been resolved. He's definitely talked about it in interviews and stuff. But as far as could it work, I think it could, and I think they would, like we said, just be YouTubers. Like, maybe they kept doing their show the way they had and continued to, you know, he continued to work those hand net jobs, as he called them. By the time, like, YouTube came around, that was what made them take off, and now they've got, like, a really successful YouTube channel, and they have to deal with whatever problem comes up. I don't know.
I think a big thing for me is, like, I just checked, like, Dana Carvey's 64. It's also the thing, like, they're also in their, like, 60s now, too, where it's, like, they're, like, I think the idea of them, like, putting on the wig and makeup again is, just, like, I don't know, like, we're very, like, we're 65-year-old men now. Like, we're, like, grown-up men, and, like, Dana Carvey's, like, basically retired from films at this point.
Yeah,
like,
that's
true. He's basically just doing, like, stand-up only or, like, voices. And, like, Mike Myers still does film, but he's, like, I don't know if he'd want to do this film again, right? Like, I think they're older than, like, Jeff Daniels and Jim Carrey are for Dumb and Dumber, or, like, Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson were for Zoolander 2, like, these, like, giant breaks, or, like, Anchorman 2, like, they're way older than those guys were when they did the, like, next one. And so I think they're just also, like, in a different place in their own lives, where it's, like, we're like, nearing kind of the end of this. We're not necessarily here to do it again.
That's a good point. Which makes me think, like, they must have been in their mid to late 30s at the time of the first film. So there you go. We'll move on to the Steve Buscemi Sparkplug Award. The contenders, Ed O'Neill, the manager of the donut shop. Mm. He was great.
Yeah.
Alice Cooper with his little soliloquy. Robert Patrick as the T-1000.
That's the winner for me, by the way. That's going to be the winner.
And then you've got Chris Farley just in his role as the security guard that knows a little too much. You've got Robert Patrick.
Yeah, because it's such a great cameo. Like, it's such a great, like, wink and, like, nod to Terminator 2. Like, and it's so funny and it's so clever, and I think it works really well. I love that one because it's, like, short, sweet, and it's, like, boom, that's perfect.
Yeah, that's a contender for most 90s moment as well because...
Yeah, right.
It's such a cultural reference, pop culture reference to the time. I don't know that, like, I mean, I guess everyone has seen Terminator 2.
Yeah, that's the problem, right?
If you haven't seen it for 10 or 15 years, if you're a young person watching this movie, you might be a little confused about why that's in here.
Sure.
If you do get the joke, you might be like, why is that here? That's so random. But yeah, they movies came out only like a year apart.
Yeah,
I think that is possibly one of the issues with this movie, and especially Wayne's World 2, is a bunch of current references that don't translate. Like, there's a whole...
They're very, of that time. Like, very, like, pop culture focused.
Yeah, like, there was one or two things in this movie that I actually don't understand what the joke is, and I can only assume that it's a cultural reference. And I know the second movie has this whole, like, Jim Morrison...
Yeah, the second movie is way worse in that regard. It's, like, that whole act.
Yeah, there's, like, the Indian, like, vision, naked Indian. I had no idea what that was about when I was a kid. I just thought it was weird and kind of funny. But knowing now that it's a reference to a film of that time, it's like, oh, okay, that doesn't quite work so well. So I think in the spirit of this award, the Sparkplug Award, Robert Patrick doesn't have enough to do. It's a great moment, but he's just kind of like, have you seen this boy? And then it's over. I think I would say Chris Farley doesn't have enough to do. As much as I love him, he might have a chance to win this award later with Billy Madison or something. But yeah, Ed O'Neill for me, like when you get introduced to his character and he's talking about his, like, how he ended up owning a donut shop and just his dark, dark inner monologue, that cracks me up. Especially, I guess people would have mostly known him as Al Bundy.
Al Bundy, Married with Children.
I almost said Ted Bundy, but no. And how did they name their character Ted Bundy? I mean, Ed Bundy? Al Bundy, yeah. I don't know how they get away with that.
Alice Cooper's great, to be fair.
As far as celebrity cameos go, he's fantastic. And apparently he didn't have any lines scripted when he first accepted the role. He just thought he was going to perform his song and say one thing. But he did great with that monologue. And that's a really cool moment where they kind of subvert the expectation of what his personality would be. But yeah, Ed O'Neill's the winner for me. He's just... a great comic talent, and it's cool to see him as a younger performer in this movie, since we've known him so well through Modern Family, I guess. Last question, is it still a good movie, Logan?
Yes, I think so. I think, like, the movie's flawed, the movie's issues, as we've kind of talked about and touched on, but, like, ultimately, I think Wayne's was really funny, and I think, like we kind of said for, like, what holds up the best, more than anything else, Mike Myers and Dana Carvey are really funny, right? And, like, Rob Lowe has his moments, and Ed O'Neill has his moments, right? And, like, the Robert Patrick scene has its moments, and Alice Cooper, like, the movie has downbeats, the movie has gags that don't work, and it has jokes that don't land, and there are some dated pop culture references, but from start to finish, there are a series of scenes and moments and jokes that do land and that are really funny, and I think the movie... is also just, like, super important in terms of, like, the direction of comedy. And, like, its impact on people also kind of going from SNL to doing their own, like, taking those characters, putting them on film. And, yeah, I think it's funny. Like, I think the Bohemian Rhapsody alone would have maybe been like, yeah, it's a good movie. Like, I don't think it's one of the greatest comedies ever made, but I think it is definitely a good movie. And I think it's definitely one of the better comedies, and certainly of the 90s. Like, that's what I would say. Like, yeah.
That's fair. I think it's a difficult thing to say because we're wearing our nostalgia goggles, and I think from that perspective you could say yes, it's still worth a rewatch. But as far as just is it a standalone good movie in a vacuum, I'm not sure I can say it is. Like, if I had a 20-year-old friend who had no context for the 90s, had no context for Wayne's World, SNL, any of that, I'm not sure I could tell them to watch this thinking that they would enjoy the whole thing.
I think you could. I think I definitely would still. I think Roger Piconi out there would still enjoy this movie.
Let's hit him up and find out, because I really would be interested and genuinely curious, because I think if you're a comedy buff and like you appreciate the history and how humor has evolved and like where jokes started and things like that, yeah, I think that you would watch this and appreciate it. But I know, like, as I was sitting there and my wife was walking in and out of the room, she was like, why do I have, like, she wanted to watch something else with me. And she was frustrated that I had this on because she just didn't get it and it wasn't appealing. Sure. And it was over the top. And if you don't get, like, this is another thing, like, you might just not get the jokes as well because of I guess, the time that's passed. So, I it's hard for me to just say this is a movie for everyone. I think if you, like you said at the start, if you appreciate the 90s, it's definitely for you. But yeah, it's a bit tougher than something like Dumb and Dumber or Happy Gilmore. I think those movies Ace hold Ventura. Up better. Yeah, Ace Ventura we'll get to in a few months.
One of my favorite comedies of all time.
Yeah, I am really intrigued by how that's going to hold up because I had such a great love for it as a teenager, but I haven't watched. I've been scared to watch
it. It's been a while since I've seen it, but like that is absolutely one of my favorite comedy films of all time. Ace Ventura, love that.
Very good. Well, thank you, Logan, for joining us.
Absolutely.
It's been great. Appreciate your wisdom, your insights, your Americanness. It's all an asset to the podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's always a pleasure to do literally anything with you, Jono. You're one of the very, very best boys out there.
Thank you.
Yeah. And again, as I said when you first announced this is such an amazing idea that I love. Just going back through 90s comedies. So yeah, it was an absolute blast.
Yeah. And I should say thank you for being a patron and for plugging the podcast when it was in that kind of crowdfunding stage and helping it get across the line. I'm glad to have you on the show to bring that full circle.
Yes.
And listeners out there, iTunes reviews, they're the way to go. They're the way to tell us that you love us. If you want to send me your questions, comments, and corrections, I can record a follow-up mini episode to respond in the weeks between new movies. That would be a pretty fun thing to do, I think, if you've got your own views, or maybe we've said something that has just triggered your sensibilities. I'm at Jono himself, Lefty Loggy, or Lefty Logie is Lefty where Logie. You can find Logan. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we're telling people how to find you, they have to be able to spell it, Logan. So, for that purpose,
LeftyLoggy, Lefty Logie, Lefty Loggy, I don't really care. Snowback Mike still just refused to only call me Lefty Loggy, but it's fine.
That's all for this week. You can join us on the next episode with DJ Payne and Sammy Deej to talk about The Big Lebowski.
Ooh.
That's going to be a good one.
That'll be a super good conversation. Yeah, I'm very excited for that.
Yeah. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us on Comedy Rewind. As always, be kind.
And rewind.